Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 96, Kalapsnik and the Ripping Yarn, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Wednesday, May 14th, 2008.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast, blowing your mind one week.
Welcome back to the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and joining me here in the Sea Realm once again is Dmitry Orlov. Dmitry is the author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. Dmitry Orlov, welcome back to the Sea Realm Podcast.
Thank you, KMO. Great to be here.
Well, I read your book quite some time ago, and I was one of the privileged advanced readers, but now your book is ready for the world. The publishing date has been in flux, but I think it will be available as of today, this being Wednesday, the 15th of May, 2008.
That's right. It's sitting in boxes at the publishers, as far as I know, and we are going to be announcing it this week in various ways, and Sea Realm is one of those ways.
It's a good week to have you on, because I'm also playing this week a recording of an interview that I did with James Howard Kunstler down in Austin, Texas a few weeks back. We were at the gathering of the Conference of the New Urbanism, and we were talking about his book, which is called World Made by Hand. And I think your book and his overlap in some sense. His is a novel, it's fiction. Your book is definitely not fiction, but they both focus on the human level experience of what may be coming in the not too distant future.
I like his book. I read it, and it's a ripping yarn, as he himself put it. You know, it's basically an adventure story, more or less a Western. You know, it's a cowboy story. There are actual horses there, and people ride around on them. And it's a great book because it brings the experience of daily existence in a post-collapse environment to the reader in a way that's not designed to shock, but to calm and to make people feel that this is something that is survivable and part of history. And it breaks down this wall that people tend to have, where there's, on the one hand, the idea of infinite technological progress and economic progress, and on the other hand, the myth of the apocalypse. And there's just nothing between them. You know, so that both Kunstler and I are trying to plug up this gigantic hole in the public imagination.
Well, you mentioned to me in an email that one thing your book does, which most books on this topic do not do, is focus on what individual people can do, and it's often said in the peak oil community that 90% of the preparation for peak oil is mental. And a lot of what we see in the media now is talk about a social level view of the problem and social level views, policy level views of projected solutions or proposed solutions, and not much about the actual experience that people will have as this transition takes place. And something that comes through in your essays, in your book, particularly from your experience traveling to Russia during the period of Soviet collapse, is that what will be remembered is not the social level, not the level of policy and the level of macroeconomics, but what will really make a mark on people and stay with them for decades is, in fact, the hardship of the personal experience that this transition will visit upon a great many people.
Yes, well, you know, the approach that works in prosperous times is to use statistics to find what one's personal niche is, because there is some kind of an economic niche. You could have a career track, for instance. You can plan for retirement. And in unsettled times, statistics, you know, based on some sample of people like you, is not really going to be a very good predictor of what is going to happen to you. It all breaks down to the individual level. And, you know, statistics doesn't work with a sample size of one, and that is what we're dealing with once all of these social systems that make us all similar to each other in some ways go away. And so it becomes the personal experience that is the focus of everything. And one of the things that I've come across is the idea, well, a lot of people, not a lot of people, the ones that have read Painter's Collapse of Complex Societies, which is a great book. I definitely recommend working through it if you have lots of time and, you know, time to think it through. One of the erroneous conclusions that people draw from it is that when societies, complex societies collapse, what you get is something simple. That is probably not really, you know, the right conclusion to draw. Everything becomes incredibly complicated. Instead of the standard client-server paradigm where you walk into a store and hand over a piece of plastic and you get some goods in return, doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter who's selling it, doesn't matter where the store is located, none of those things are relevant. It's all very streamlined and simplified. Instead of that, everything gets reduced to personal relationships between two people, maybe three people, but it's really all one-on-one, and it's all a question of who you know and how you relate to them. And the complexity, the level of the sort of chaotic, unstreamlined, unsystematized complexity becomes extreme. So that just about everything that happens to you seems like an accident. Life becomes a series of accidents. And a lot of the psychological adaptations that have to happen is, you know, developing the flexibility to actually be able to cope with that sort of an unsettled environment and to improvise and not be too stressed by the fact that you're really not in control, and in fact no one is in control.
Well, giving up the illusion of control can certainly be a painful transition. You've talked about something called collapse, but collapse is a very oversimplified term when it comes to sort of capturing the nuances and the diversity of the experience that is likely to be coming to us in the not-too-distant future. One thing that Jim Kunstler is fond of pointing out is that the part of the country in which he lives is somewhat better prepared for a discontinuity of our essential services and a breakdown of the larger financial and governmental systems that keep everything running smoothly. And that certain parts of the U.S., say the Southwest, for instance, are in for a very tough time in comparison. And I know that just the word collapse by itself can really usefully be broken down into a lot of different stages. And I know you've done that in a recent entry on your blog. And if you would, tell us about those different stages of collapse.
What I have attempted is one of those bold conjectures where you basically just try something and see if it works. I'm not convinced that it works yet. You know, I have to test this theoretical framework that I've cobbled together. It's not really something that you can easily demonstrate, but on some level it makes sense. And the idea is that basically what gives us a sense of things being normal is people in general making certain assumptions about the status quo. And those assumptions are made on their face in the continued existence and viability of various social arrangements and institutions. So what I did was look at those levels of faith that might be broken at various times, and the results and whether one type of failure cascades to the next, which is really the most important question. So I identified five stages of collapse, you know, and I called them financial, commercial, political, social, and cultural. I thought about those words for a few days, and, you know, it sort of gelled. And the levels of faith associated with them are faith in the world of finance, that your money in the bank is safe and that your investment company is actually going to mail you a check for the distribution at some point, as opposed to mailing you a letter saying we're sorry. That you will get your retirement savings back in some form later on, and that it will be more money than you need to, say, buy a cup of coffee. Those sorts of things. And we're actually experiencing, a mild form of financial collapse, but it could get worse. And then commercial collapse is something that financial collapse can turn into if markets are sufficiently financialized if they depend on availability of credit, which in this case they do. And then that what follows later as the tax base collapses because of the previous two collapses is a political collapse where government is immobilized and people lose faith that their government will take care of them and that there will be government services to take care of them, emergency services, garbage removal, public utilities, things like that. And then what that can lead to is society weakened to a point where social institutions, whatever they be, charities, churches, community groups, will also stop functioning, and people will lose faith in their ability to organize at a grassroots level to do anything useful. And the last stage of collapse is really what threatens the existence of humans as a species, which is cultural collapse, you know, inability to teach one's children the techniques that they need to live, you know, inability to make peace with your neighbors. And what's lost at that stage is faith in the goodness of humanity. You know, this is not something that, you know, most of us like to think about, but this is certainly something to, by all means, try to avoid. And my whole point is that, you know, it doesn't have to be a continuous plunge to the bottom. You know, we can't have a financial collapse without a commercial collapse. We can have a commercial collapse without a political collapse. All of these things are possibilities. We should think about them. You know, we should try to avoid falling through to the next level. And I would say that the last two levels, and the last level especially, are just simply not negotiable. Those are the two where, you know, failure should not be considered an option. It's great to, you know, simplify your arrangements, but not to that extent.
There's a book that you mentioned in your blog entry on this topic. It's called The Mountain People. And I think it involves a group in Africa who are migratory and spend certain parts of the year in one location and certain parts in another. And due to political turmoil, they can't traverse their normal range and they get stuck in one place. And if you would say a bit about the experience of the mountain people and what that tells us about that particular level of collapse and why it is so illustrative of why we should avoid it.
Well, Colin Turnbull is an anthropologist. He's living in Connecticut now, and he's no longer writing on the mountain people. This was just one book that he wrote. And it's remarkable because, you know, as so many things, I think he came up with a real gem inadvertently. His previous work was on the forest people, pygmies, that have a wonderful, peaceful, harmonious society. And you know, it's almost like an elegy to an Eden-like existence. And then his next book was about this tribe called the Ichien, or the Ik, as he calls them, who are hunter-gatherers that were restricted to a tiny portion of their range to a set of barren mountains that they used to call their home. It's sort of their spiritual home. You know, it's where they kept certain key artifacts that defined them as a people in their eyes. But it was not a place that could provide them with sustenance. And they were basically blockaded in these barren mountains and told to grow food, but it only rained there about one out of every 3 years, I recall. So they were always on the verge of starvation and resorted to eating carrion. And Colin was almost... It's strange reading that book because he was almost like a deer caught in the headlights because he approached the society with certain preconceived notions of what humanity is like and, you know, thinking that there's some basic level to family life and relationships between people, that, you know, for instance, parents take care of their young, you know, that elders are treated with respect. All of these notions that he had to completely throw away because this is basically a people going extinct. They know they're going extinct. They're reconciled to not being a thriving normal race. And so their survival technique is basically the preservation of breeding couples. Children don't matter because you can always have more. Old people certainly don't matter because they can't have children. And even within the breeding couples, you don't really want to support people unless they can support themselves because you're just creating dependence. So, for instance, food isn't shared even within the family. Children are basically chased out of the house at the age of 3. So this is a very extreme society, you know, at some point of decomposition. And he comes up with some very interesting observations that, you know, I was just, you know, interested to read, for instance, that the basic value of people, living, live people, is as entertainment. Because basically dead people are not that much fun. Live people are more fun. So that's probably the only reason that these ick, you know, make any effort whatsoever to keep each other alive. And the other reason that they keep each other alive is that dead people are work, because you have to bury them. You know, you have to dig a hole in the ground, and that's hard work. But that is really, you know, humanity reduced to the absolutely the lowest level at which it can still be said to continue to exist. And it's really something worth reading for anyone who thinks that, you know, that there is some something called humanism that is universal. Because it turns out that it's only something that can exist while the circumstances are relatively good, and there can be some hope in the future. But once those things are knocked out, then something else takes over, and it's interesting to find out what humans really are under those circumstances. And reading Collins' book is a way to do that.
Well, in the language of collapse that you've laid out with these 5 stages, would you describe the experience of the Soviet Union in the 90s?
Well, it's actually, you know, the Soviet collapse was in some ways collapse light in some ways. And, you know, there were some severe social dislocations. There was a spike in the mortality rate. But basically, Soviet society did not really have any sort of financial basis to it. Most of the financial problems had to do with inability to continue importing as much food and consumer products as they were used to, as they became accustomed to while oil prices were high and while oil production was booming. But unlike the United States, there wasn't a lot of personal finance. You know, people really were just given everything they needed to live. Money just didn't play that important a role. Commercial collapse was definitely something that I, myself, you know, one summer I showed up there, and there was no food in the stores, and, you know, most of the stores were just closed. There weren't the usual lines everywhere. You know, there was some food you could buy at open air markets and such, but it was too expensive for a lot of people. There were people, middle class people, looking for food in the garbage. You know, that's about the worst that I've seen. And so commercial collapse definitely affected it. Political collapse, of course, occurred in the dramatic disappearance of the Soviet Union, but what came out of it is Russia, which for a time had a fairly weak central government and had some rather unsuccessful experiments with devolving authority to the regions, where regional governors were for a time elected, and with some very mixed results. And there were some separatist movements that gained traction for a time. But it wasn't a wholesale political collapse. In terms of social collapse, Russian families turned out to, you know, have quite a bit of strength to them, and the culture turned out to be rather resilient in some ways. But there was a great number of people who had bought into the Soviet system and were shocked to discover that it went away. And a lot of the people that were active and had careers in the Soviet times, who found themselves completely sidelined, just lost their weight, and a lot of them drank themselves to death. There were a lot of suicide. There was just a lot of despair and disorientation. And I think that's something that is almost unavoidable, but to some extent it's preventable. And that's one of the things that I would like to achieve, you know, for myself and others, you know, is the understanding that, you know, life goes on and you just adapt, and it's not really all that important to be so fully vested in the status quo at the moment.
Well, to that end, I think you have been largely successful, and this is my measure for that. There are a great many people who have no interest in the larger project of the Sea Realm podcast, but they definitely tune in when Dmitry Orlov is on. And when you were first in the process of approaching a publisher and getting your book accepted for publication, they weren't sure that there was a market for it. And now that your book is just about ready to be released to the public, half the first print run has been sold in advance. So there's definitely been a shift in consciousness in the general public. What do you see in terms of that shift of consciousness, and where do you see it going?
Well, it's almost a frightening thing for me, because I feel like I'm becoming mainstream. 2 years ago, when I first started writing on the subject, I'm not even sure why. I think my initial impulse was governed by this feeling that it's really pleasurable to express the truth, whatever your heartfelt belief is in what is really the case, what is really true. So I did it for almost an egotistical reason, and then it sort of morphed into something else. But it was a very fringy thing that I was doing. What people thought I was doing was strange, comparing the Soviet Union to the United States. First of all, how dare I? And secondly, am I insane, Now it's almost commonplace, and I never get any argument. I could talk to anyone from any part of the American political spectrum, such as it is, and I don't really get any kind of an adverse reaction. And it's very odd. It's very strange. There are things happening that people don't really talk about, but it seems like there's a psychological shift happening. I talk to all kinds of different people, but just like the types of people that I talk to here at a boatyard where my boat is, where I'm working on my boat, they're retired dentists who are working on their yacht, and then on the other hand, there are the roustabouts who get an hourly wage for, doing this and that. But you can hear them say the same thing, or, they will say that, money doesn't matter. The important thing is to have enough time left to do what you want in your life. You can always make more money, but you can't make more time, And that just runs across the entire socioeconomic spectrum. People don't really believe that, being plugged into the system is going to get them what they want. And it doesn't have anything to do with whether it's been getting them what they want so far or not, It seems to be, one of those mental shifts that's happening.
In some ways, it seems like there's a little bit of element of payback, in that the people who are hit hardest by the collapse are the people who were doing the best in the previous system. And as you mentioned, some of the most dynamic, accomplished people in the Soviet Union ended up drinking themselves to death when the system that they had been so invested in and so successful in collapsed. And I struggle with this myself, because I really don't want to look forward to any sort of human misery, but at the same time, the growing gap and the growing inequities between those who are doing well and those who are not doing well really makes it hard not to be somewhat of a cheerleader for at least some stage of collapse.
Yes, first of all, being a cheerleader for a collapse is, just a really odd thing. It would be completely disingenuous of me to advance the notion that, it's all going to collapse and you won't be able to buy my book because there won't be money and, commerce will break down. That would just be silly. I'm not in favor of collapse. And the one thing that I would like to point out is that the notions of success that people are used to are not necessarily valid even today. So that if you look at a lot of the people who are quote-unquote successful, they may be successful by some measure, but it may not be a valid measure. for them even today if what you look for is happiness and fulfillment and security. You know, they may have a job, you know, but and it may give them money, okay, but how important is that in the scheme of things? And what I'm hearing from a lot of people, whether they have money or not, whether they have a job or not, that it's not very important.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast. Turn on, tune in, and take heart.
That was Dmitry Orlov, author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. And Dmitry will be back in next Wednesday's episode of the Sea Realm podcast. That will be episode number 98.